From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we learn about the growing need for cybersecurity professionals at a wide range of companies in the U.S.
Later, a renowned academic inventor breaks down some myths about how invention happens and what it takes to get a patent.
To get something patented, you have to show that it's novel, it hasn't been done before. It's got to be non-obvious, so something that's not obvious to somebody who is in that field. They wouldn't say, oh, that's just anybody could have thought of that. And it's got to have some use. It's got to be useful.
And musician Jason Seed reflects on his compositional style.
I always feel like there has to be something of a narrative, you know, some type of developmental aspect to what's happening, where ideas lead from one to the next in a way that seems both organic and emergent.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this year, a report on NPR said that cyber attacks originating in China are continuing to increase, even as the number of indictments and charges against hackers has increased as well. The proliferation of online transactions and the so-called Internet of Things, devices that allow us to connect remotely, has raised the risk of hacking across a wide spectrum of our lives.
But while indictments and arrests are happening, the problem is outpacing the efforts of people who do cybersecurity work, in part because there are not enough of them. Jen Rathburn is a partner with the law firm of Foley & Lardner, specializing in data protection and security. Tina Chang is the CEO of Wisconsin-based SysLogic, which works in the cybersecurity field. They spoke with us in February. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So what's happening here? Why has the need for cybersecurity professionals outpaced the supply?
Well, they predict by 2021 there'll be 3.5 million unfilled jobs in cybersecurity. And I think really that comes from the fact that cyber attacks are increasing. You know, the cost of cyber attacks are now over $1.1 million on average. That's new stats coming out in January. On average, it takes 201 days to even find a cyber attacker. You know, information systems are getting more complex. We're introducing, you know, the Internet of Things and IoT. Every company wants to be a data company. And so for all of those reasons, you know, it's just becoming a lot more sophisticated systems to protect, and the attackers are becoming more sophisticated. And the funds, unfortunately, to fund cybersecurity within companies is still on the lower side.
This is the idea that that companies are adopting all sorts of IoT solutions to their products, but the kinds of attacks they might experience, they're not necessarily predicting, and so suddenly they find themselves realizing that they don't have the kind of security that they need.
Yes, oftentimes, or there's new viruses, there's zero-day events. There's lots of sophisticated attackers from, you know, other governments, APT attacks, which we talk about. So attacks are just have been on the rise in the past couple of years. And so there's more need for cybersecurity professionals, not just from a technical perspective, but also from a legal and compliance perspective, because many different frameworks are now being passed through onto companies. For example, if you're a government contractor for Department of Defense, you have to comply with certain frameworks. If you're in the healthcare industry, if you are in the financial industry, many people have heard about GDPR, which is a European law that came into effect last May. California is implementing a new law to be effective. So there's just an uptick not only in attacks, but also legal and compliance requirements.
Tina Chang, where does your company find itself in this equation?
So we are a 23-year-old information services firm, and I'll tell you, while cybersecurity has existed for a long time, we've seen an incredible uptick over the last 6 years. And going back to what Jen had talked about regarding Internet of Things, I think part of the momentum is really because organizations are looking more and more not only to connect within their organizations, but connect outside of their organizations. And anytime you are reaching outside of your organization and connecting in ways that you haven't before, you are opening up walls that you have been traditionally used to protecting. So we've come into play really helping organizations not only innovate around innovative things, but then understanding, and more importantly, how they protect as they're connecting with their customers or their supply chain even more.
Have you experienced this this shortage, if you will?
Definitely. Absolutely. We've had open positions for the last 3 years that go unfilled, and we are no different than many organizations, both public and private. So as Jen had mentioned, we are going to have over 3 million unfilled positions worldwide. And this really puts a challenge not only on education and academia to groom, but also on the private sector to upskill and train, because you can hire every single person that's going to be coming out of a program in the near term, and you still won't fill the labor shortage.
So within the general field, give us a sense for, you know, what are the kinds of positions that are out there when we're talking about cybersecurity professionals? What are we talking about?
Sure. So I think most people tend to think about them as the technical, really behind the computer types. And it's not just that. Jen had mentioned that cybersecurity really, it stretches across a vast array of skill sets, from governance and compliance that really get into the legal and insurance worlds, all the way down to operations and technical. We tend to focus on the technical side at SysLogic, which then opens up dozens and dozens of different types of security jobs and skill sets that are required, everything from perimeter and network security, now all the way through application and data security, with the notion that we were used to just protecting our walls, making sure somebody didn't get into our house. Now we have to assume that they're going to get into the house, and then we have to understand how to protect what's in it, the applications, the data, or the content that's really valuable.
And, you know, it's not just technical. What I have seen, which is very interesting, what Tina brought up, is that we do assume now that you are not going to prevent a cyber attack. It's really to prepare for a cyber attack. So a few years ago, I mean, really the theme has switched from, you know, having IT just handle cybersecurity. It's really a risk management issue. It's a strategy issue. I mean, one of the number one thing you can do is develop an incident response team and a plan to respond to a cyber attack. And who's the best at that? Individuals that are thinking strategy. So really, it's moving, preventing cyber attacks and, you know, preparing for them up to the C-suite. So it's risk managers, it's legal, it's compliance. A lot of chief information security officers, CISOs as we call them, a lot of those individuals are actually now becoming lawyers or compliance officials. And instead of reporting directly up to the CIO, they're having either cross reports or direct reports up to legal and compliance because, you know, a lot of times in companies, people just want to roll out the new laptop. They want the new piece of technology. But the chief information security officer really is responsible for looking at privacy by design, security by design. If we implement this new piece of technology, are we bringing too much security risk in? So it's really, it's like thinking outside the box of lots of different individuals that could fill these roles.
You're absolutely right, Jen. And to your point, it is stretching technology people to have to be strategists, to not just do, but to think.
Well,
and that's a new realm.
And that must mean also that if we're talking about taking people who aren't traditionally technology people and moving them into the technology field.
You betcha. I liken this to the very early days when websites started to emerge. Everybody thought it was a technical person that was there to create a website. And what we quickly recognize is that this was one of those areas that stretched across an enterprise, from strategy to marketing to communications to the business units. And cyber is no different. And so what we're seeing, or at least what I'm seeing, is the best types of cyber professionals tend to be very collaborative. They are committed to being intellectually curious and curious about what's happening and how others think, so that they could understand and predict what doesn't even exist today. And I think when you end up pairing collaboration with curiosity and then a very, very deep commitment to research, it makes you one that's constantly looking for that next thing. And that's what cyber is really about, because it's constantly changing. The viruses are constantly changing.
And also communication. I mean, as we all know, a lot of individuals in the technical field are linear thinkers, and sometimes they get really deep into the technical speak. I find that a lot of really successful cybersecurity professionals are able to take that, you know, deep technical knowledge and be able to communicate risk in particular to the board. Because the board, it's very difficult. Many board members have no technical background. And so being a very good communicator as well is very helpful.
Well, and so what's the kind of work that the business community can be doing with academia so that the people who are coming out of school in a variety of fields find themselves, you know, either funneled or considering this profession?
So I think the private sector in working with academia, it really starts with a partnership of how do we bring people from the private sector that can even help teach the curriculum to the academic centers, because right now it's not like you have a plethora of trained professors in cybersecurity. So you've got to activate that from the private sector, bring them into the university or even high school levels to start planting seeds of how to think about cyber. The other thing that we've seen a couple of the local institutions here do really well is they're reaching out to private sector to saying, what does that curriculum even look like, right? So if you're actually doing this work on the ground, how do you help us make this not only practical, but thoughtful in the way that we're designing people on how to think for the future? And private sector is going to help academia get there. Academia will not get there on their own.
And, you know, we just hosted a few weeks ago with the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance, we did a workforce development session, and the assistant dean from UWM came and spoke. And it's really trying to also get students interested in this area. You know, I think a lot of students think it's very technical, and maybe, you know, some of them think it's not as exciting as as we do. But really, I mean, cybersecurity professionals, and I mean this truly, are the superheroes. I mean, what is happening is, in particular in the Midwest, you know, we're getting hit by these very sophisticated attackers. I mean, they really are our frontline defense to defend our companies, to protect our IP, to protect consumer information. And the more information that leaves our doors, it really affects the U.S.'s competitive advantage. And so they really are pseudo-military. They are our first line of defense. I mean, the government is not able to put, you know, individuals into all of our companies, and nobody's breaking in anymore on foot. They're not going to come in and steal something. They're going to steal it through, you know, a cyber, you know, connection, you know, through networks, et cetera. And so it's a really exciting job. And I want Tina to talk about it, but Tina has a really good idea about how to get more individuals interested in this.
Do we need to get them uniforms, badges, capes?
Hey, listen, capes. You know, I definitely, you joke, but I definitely think that cyber needs a rebrand. So to Jen's point, these are really heroes. And the trouble with cyber attacks is typically nobody wants to talk about them. So it's almost the more quiet it is, the better life is. But the people doing the work behind the scenes are truly doing work that can cause companies and organizations millions of dollars if not done right. So
how much are you looking for realized talent versus recognizing potential in this field?
We are definitely looking for potential in this field. If we just left our recruiting team to look for realized talent, they'll be looking forever. Not only because there are absolutely more jobs than there are people, but the competition for those people is fierce. And so recommendation number one to companies is please show a little love to your cyber people, because I guarantee you everybody is calling on them right now to try and recruit them away from you. That being said, you really have to identify talent and interest internal to your organization, whether they have competency or not, and train them, because this is a field that everybody's learning. Everybody's learning at the same time. So it leads itself to a vast opportunity for us to look at alternative worker channels and people that are underemployed and or want career shifts, and really groom them into a field that, again, is new to everybody.
Oh, I was just going to ask how you recognize potential.
Well, I think you recognize potential is what Tina said before, is somebody that's really interested in the space and is a good communicator and may have non-traditional skills that are, you know, auditing skills. A lot of the cybersecurity frameworks, you know, are based on auditing, come from a compliance environment, not just technical. But in the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance meeting, you know, we had a large group of people. It was actually co-hosted by InfraGuard, which is a public-private partnership with the FBI. But I will tell you that, you know, a lot of the individuals in the audience said, I won't move for more money, but I really want training. I mean, they really want training because, again, they are our first line of defense. You know, they feel cybersecurity individuals, in the event a company experiences an incident, which almost all do, they feel very guilty and they're just wanting to suck in training. So I would say to any company to keep your individuals happy, which, by the way, they get about 50 emails a week for new jobs, just so everybody knows, is to really invest in that training because that is what I would say from the audience last week is the number one thing they're looking for.
Definitely. And as a firm, I will mention that training is huge. And the number one area that I don't think corporations and organizations do well is to provide that training budget. Everybody wants training, of course, but cybersecurity is one of those fields that you absolutely must have it. Or watch out, the investment that you're making in your people will lag very quickly because they're not keeping up with the pace of the change. That being said, I think locally here, we need more. We need more of our academic partners to step up with programs. They are starting to emerge, so that is great to see. We're seeing some momentum. I think we could fuel that momentum with some investments from the private sector. But also, Syslogic recognizes that there isn't a lot of local training. And so we're coming out with one of the only locally provided training programs on cybersecurity next month.
Well, Tina Chang, Jen Rathburn, thank you both so much. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Jen Rathburn is a partner with the law firm of Foley & Lardner, specializing in data protection and security. Tina Chang is the CEO of Wisconsin-based Syslogic, which works in the cybersecurity field. Our conversation with them first aired in February.
A short break now, and then a conversation about how inventors go about their work in the 21st century. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back now with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In an era where innovation and entrepreneurship are prized concepts, the term inventor might, at first blush, seem a bit quaint. But invention is still very much a viable skill. In fact, it's seen by many as the cornerstone of innovation, and it's something that's especially valued in academic research settings.
Dr. Jay Goldberg is being recognized for his considerable work as an inventor in academia. Goldberg is a clinical professor of biomedical engineering and the director of the Healthcare Technologies Management Program at Marquette University and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Most recently, he's been elected a fellow of the National Academy of Inventors.
That is the highest professional distinction for academic inventors. Goldberg holds several patents for medical devices and leads an effort at Marquette to develop an entrepreneurial mindset among both faculty and students. Goldberg talked with WUWM innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach and explained that the common image of the lone inventor at work in his or her lab doesn't hold true.
Inventions are created by teams of people. Could be two people, could be 10 people, could be more. I think that's kind of a myth, the lone inventor in their garage or their basement and they come up with something to save the world. It's really a team effort because it requires so many different areas of knowledge to come together and really very few people have all that knowledge, you know, all the knowledge they need to get a patent.
I think people are always fascinated as to where and when creative people get started on things. Did you take things apart or create them as a child or a little bit later?
When I was probably 4 years old, my parents bought me my first Lego kit, and that's when Legos came out. Back then, they didn't come with instructions on how to build things. You just had to use your imagination to design and build things. And I honestly think that's what got me interested in science, engineering, that kind of thing. When I was a little bit older, I tried building some electronic kits. One was an FM transmitter, one was a shortwave radio kit. So I became interested in the parts that go into these things. That's when I became very interested in science and math and building things.
That's nice. You've worked part of your career as an adult then on medical devices. What's one you think has helped the most people or that you're most proud of? Talk about one or two.
One that is patented is it's a ureteral stent. It's a device, a tubular device that goes between the kidney and the bladder to maintain urinary drainage. Sometimes it can be uncomfortable. So I have a patent for one of these where the part that sits in the kidney is really soft. Actually, that part is a little stiffer to keep the stent from falling out of the body, and the rest of the stent is kind of soft. And it may not sound like much of a challenge, but to manufacture that with different stiffnesses within the same material was a challenge, and that's what the patent covered. The other one that I'm proud of is a biodegradable ureteral stent. So this is a stent, much like the first one I described, that once it's implanted, after a period of a few weeks, it actually dissolves. So the patient doesn't have to go back to the hospital and have anesthesia and take time off from work and have a procedure that's expensive to remove the stent. It would just dissolve by itself. It would be safer for the patient. It would save a lot of money. We did a small clinical study, and it turns out it needed some design tweaks. And at that point, I left the company and moved on to something else.
But both of those devices were talking about helping a very basic human function of excreting waste.
Absolutely. And that, but also to treat people with kidney stones. Sometimes you get a stone and it blocks flow and it can cause all sorts of problems. So this helped with the treatment of stones and maintaining drainage. Yep.
Talk a little bit about the challenges to getting inventions patented or otherwise coming to a wider audience.
To get something patented, you have to show that it's novel. It hasn't been done before. It's got to be non-obvious, so something that's not obvious to somebody who is in that field. They wouldn't say, oh, that's just anybody could have thought of that. And it's got to have some use. It's got to be useful. Fulfilling those three criteria can be a challenge. But I think what's made it easier for me was these patents, these were projects I worked on when I worked in the medical device industry. And I worked very closely with surgeons and other medical people in the operating room, observing procedures, learning about what our customers' problems were. So I was right in that area, and it's very easy for me to identify where the needs were. Working in an academic environment, I don't have an active research program. My time is spent half with administration and half with teaching. I'm not familiar with what the real problems are right now. So I'm not sure what to invent, what to work on. And that to me, really, looking back on it, I think that's the biggest challenge. The technical design part, that's challenging, but knowing what the problems are so that you invent something that somebody actually wants, that's a challenge.
And of course, you want things that are safe and useful, and people may have ideas, and there needs to be some sort of checks and balances and tests along the series of testing, right?
Absolutely. With medical devices, the FDA has certain requirements. You have to prove that it's safe and effective in that it does what you claim it's going to do. So there's quite a bit of testing that's involved with that. When you work for a company, the resources are there. The people are there to help you with that. There's money to pay for that. Patent attorneys, they're expensive. Working for a company, those resources are available. In academia, those resources are available too, but not quite as readily as in an industrial setting.
In what year did you make the transition from inventor to Marquette?
That was in 1999.
Okay.
I got my PhD a little bit later than most people. I went back when I was 36. Decided that the projects I liked the most were the very research-intensive ones, and I wanted to go back and learn how to do that. So 1999, I came here, and that's when I started, instead of developing new products and inventing and things like that, I realized my mission at Marquette there's a niche that I fill because of my industry experience, and that is to prepare students for life after graduation. That can be working in industry like I did. That could be going to graduate school, which I also did. That could be working in the government sector. That could be going to law school or something in a totally different direction. So my goal has been to do that. In teaching the senior design class, basically what I'm doing is using what I learned in industry and sharing it with the students and using real-world examples. When we talk about a topic, instead of just reading it and thinking, well, that's something from a book, I can give them examples of how we use that information that's in the book, how we applied it to a real-life product. There are other things that aren't in the book, like communication skills and emotional intelligence, things like that. There are chapters on teamwork, but there's certain things that aren't even in teamwork books. So things that I can share with them that I learned in my industry experience that will better prepare them for careers in industry. And even for the students, we tell them on the first day, if you're going to go to medical school, there are a lot of transferable skills you're going to learn from this course that, yes, if you don't go in industry, you may not go that path, but you can use it no matter where you go. Everybody's going to work with somebody. So there's your team. It could be two people, it could be 100 people. You're going to learn teamwork skills, communication skills, how to sell your idea. You need that in every career. So that's one of the things that I do here at Marquette, and that's what I see as my mission.
Talk a little about the creative spirit of the young people you work with these days. And there's also a Keen grant involved in at least one of the institutions. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I'll talk about the Keen grant. The Kern Family Foundation is based locally here in Waukesha, and they're promoting what they call the entrepreneurial mindset. It's not really about starting companies, but it's about having our engineers think like entrepreneurs, focus on the customer. In the past, I would say in the 70s, the 60s, even before that, what would happen a lot of times with engineers in industry would be they would be told, design this part. But they wouldn't be told why, who's going to use it, just design it with these specifications. What we're trying to do is create engineers who want to know more. They want to meet the customer. They want to observe the customer using the product so they can observe firsthand what the problem is. When I worked in industry, one of the companies that I worked for, their policy was, well, our physicians will describe the problem to the salesperson. They'll describe it to the marketing person. The marketing person will tell it to you. Well, if you've ever played the game of telephone, this is what's happening. So by the time I got the information I needed, most of what I needed was not there. It was altered. They didn't really pick up on what I thought was important. So it's very important for our engineers to understand what the customer needs, to observe things being used. And in doing so, they can also identify some problems that need to be met. And sometimes these turn into new product ideas. In fact, some of the best product ideas come from that.
Do you ever have challenges with the customer or the layperson not being able to describe their problem as well?
That happens. What happens more is they describe the wrong problem. Well, they think that they need this widget, but when the team, when the students, and we talk with them about their problem, we realize that that widget is one of many solutions, but there might be a better solution. But let's look at the real problem and focus on that. And we've had projects, we have a few each year, some student projects where because they've spent a lot of time identifying the problem, they were able to focus on the real problem and come up with a product that actually solved the problem as opposed to solving the wrong problem.
We cover startups a little bit here at WWM, startup businesses. And is there any, at your part of the education process, talk about finding money to fund these great ideas? Is that sort of the reality check for some folks?
Yes, to answer your question, that is a challenge. But, you know, one of the things we'd like our students to do, I see a lot of our senior capstone design teams develop technologies or devices that have commercial value. And we have resources at Marquette to help move it along the process. But what I'm finding is that very few of them want to pursue these projects after they graduate because they want to go to graduate school, start a job. They want to move on with their lives, and I can't blame them. That's the barrier. Yes, getting funding can be difficult too, but getting them to perhaps take a year off, do a gap year, work on your project, see if you could advance it along the commercialization process to the point where maybe you want to start a company around it. We're kind of running into a barrier where students, you know, they want to move on to other things. They're not really interested in stopping their lives to potentially, you know, create this company centered around their project.
Is that partly because of the cost of education? They might have loans to pay off and so on?
Yeah, I'm sure that is part of it. Yeah, and some of them would like to work for, talking about that Keen grant, there's a term called intrapreneur, and that is an entrepreneur that works for an established company. So entrepreneurs are typically thought of as starting the company and all that, taking the risk of starting a company. But there's also intrapreneurs who really function as entrepreneurs, but within an established company. They may create a new division or a new product line. And I think some of our students are more interested in doing that than they are taking on the risk of starting a company. We do have a few each year that are interested, but in the medical device area, it takes so much to get a product into the market. There's clinical studies. There's all sorts of other things you need to do. It's very expensive. That's very different than developing an app. We do have some teams that have created companies based on apps, but in the medical device area, which is really kind of what I'm focused on, we're not seeing a lot of new venture formation out of students, you know, immediately graduating from college.
Your prescription for improving that? How do we improve that?
There are resources available to students who might want to start a team. Typically, students you know, graduating from undergrad programs, they're not really experienced. They don't have life experience. None of them have experience running a company. So there are people that will advise them and provide some management and leadership. But I think another thing that might work would be have some type of a fellowship, 1 or 2 year fellowship that, okay, you get this, here's money. You're not going to get rich off of it, but it's like a stipend for a graduate student where they can cover their expenses and give them some space to work on their projects. They can still pay off their loans. They can still eat. They don't have to live with their parents. But yet, at the same time, continue to work on their project. And if it doesn't work, then they can move on to a job, go to graduate school. But they've gained some really good experience in the field. And if it does work, well, it works. And they can move on to the next phase of commercialization.
And then if we turn to today's youngsters who are using Lego sets or something, what do we need to do to produce the next class of inventors 10, 20, 30 years from now? There's the science, technology, engineering, and math programs. Do you back that? How do we get today's young folks inventing things 20 years from now?
I think through STEM efforts, we can do that. I think we can encourage them to be creative, allowing them to kind of imagine things and be curious about things. One of the things that the Kern Family Foundation supports, now this is at the collegiate level, but they also make efforts. They have Project Lead the Way, doing exactly what you're talking about. They're encouraging the development of entrepreneurship, skill sets, things like that, the mindset earlier. And one of the things that they really promote is curiosity, connections, and creating value, where we want our students, not just college students, to be curious about the world around them. How does the world work? How do people interact with each other? How do things work? The connections part of this would be, how do you connect information from what appears to be different areas but could be related? If you're trying to solve a problem in a particular area, step out of that area, look at some other area that might have solved a similar problem. Maybe that can help you with your solution. And then the third thing is creating value, learning to create things that people want. So I think those are the things that they promote. And by promoting that at an earlier age, that helps. But also making it cool to be interested in science and in math, things like that, so that students don't shy away from that, that they really are interested in it, they have a passion for that. That should be encouraged and nurtured.
Jay Goldberg is a clinical professor of biomedical engineering and the director of the Healthcare Technologies Management Program at Marquette University and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's recently been elected a fellow of the National Academy of Inventors. Goldberg spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter, Chuck Kornbach.
Coming up, we catch up with the Jason Seed String Tet when Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. On Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM 89.7. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. That is the distinctive sound of the Jason Seed String Tet. It's chamber music to be sure, but is it chamber folk, chamber jazz, something, something, crossover, something?
Seed's compositions have married the timbres of electric guitar, piano, violin, viola, cello, and double bass since 2008. And Seed is very proud that among other accolades, some of their music has been featured on Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Seed now lives in Chicago, but he returns to Milwaukee often to practice and perform. Three of the band members play in the Milwaukee Symphony and live here. So it was here in Milwaukee last August at Cloudland Studio on the East Side that I caught up with the group as they were presenting some new music to a small invited audience. This tune is called Pinch.
Thank you.
Jason Seed Stringtead, it is so great to talk with you again. Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And let's go around and introduce for people who aren't here sitting in the studio with us, who you are and what you play.
My name is Jason Seed, and I do all the compositions and arrangements and play guitar.
And I'm Glenn Ash, and I play violin.
I'm Marianne Parker, and I play piano.
Scott Tisdall, cello.
Dan Armstrong, bass.
I'm Helen Reich. I play viola.
Most of you have been in the studio before, and we should say we're not in Lake Effect Studio this time. We are in Cloudland Recording Studio, and this is an amazing space. Thank Larry for letting us do this. This is an amazing thing. And you are new to this, and how did you get connected with these guys?
So I believe it was about a year and a half ago, the summer of 2016, Dan Armstrong got in touch with me, and the Stringtett was playing a show at Piano Forte Studios in the South Loop of Chicago, and it was a benefit concert for the Kovler Center, and I believe it was the first time that they had played a show with piano for the recent time. So I'm not sure how Dan...
We quick came up with some arrangements.
Yeah.
No, I think we must have had some arrangements.
Yes.
Marianne came very highly recommended from some of the people that I know at the Chicago Symphony. And Marianne has a lot of experience in working with groups
and new music.
Played with Civic Orchestra in Chicago. And
how is it working with this kind of group and this kind of arrangement of stuff?
Oh, well, I tend, as you might know, Jason tends toward very highly rhythmic, complex metric pieces. And I tend to gravitate toward that myself.
Right,
I play with a lot of percussionists right up my alley. So I love it.
Yeah, I noticed listening to the concert earlier that has not changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the tone and some of the color has shifted a bit since the last time you guys were in. But that wonderfully complex rhythmic stuff is still going on.
Yeah, that's always going to be in everything. I'd love that kind of area of music as a kind of base to have things melodically go over, you know?
I think one of the things we talked about when we first were in the studio was the idea of modern music. So much of it gets a bad rap because it doesn't think about melody.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've always loved about the way you all make music is that all of those complexities are there, but there's also a melodic thread that takes you through as a listener. And I think that marries the, you know, kind of hearkening back to the quote-unquote classical as well as jazz and all of those other things that you bring into it. But there you are, and you have some place to kind of set your ears,
right,
if that makes sense.
That's what makes total sense. I always feel like there has to be something of a narrative, you know, some type of developmental aspect to what's happening, where ideas lead from one to the next in a way that seems both organic and emergent.
So how has it evolved? I'm leaving Jason onto this question right now. For those of you who've been with the group pretty much since the beginning, how have things evolved?
I think that the pieces have gotten more sophisticated. because I remember Jason's earlier chamber music pieces, and it was a much smaller group then, even. It was just four of us. It was just Jason and me and Glenn and Dan. So it was just violin, viola, bass, and guitar. And I think that the pieces have evolved since then, since those earlier ones.
There's still a lot of those older tunes that I love going back to. Where the corners meet.
Yeah,
Pinch has been around for a long time. We could go back to some of the tunes that I think you've lost the original files for. Pandora that we did a long time ago.
I would love to do that.
I mean, you've been writing great music for a while.
Thanks.
And it's rare that we play a concert where Jason hasn't come up with something that's new.
It's true.
And I don't know where you find the time. He's got a full-time job in Chicago, and as you said in our concert, sometimes you compose in your sleep, but
if you got the electrodes, you know, right, attached to your brain while you're sleeping, so it just like transfers
just straight to MIDI, so
exactly.
It can output the notation.
Take it right there.
I'm curious, as a newcomer, are the arrangements that various members in the group write, is that a relatively new thing for the ensemble?
Yeah.
Yeah, we all have our kind of pet bands that we like. I mean, I'm a Yes fan, and Dan is into the Eastern European and what was the
name? African. That's right.
And so we've
just whatever comes up, you know.
Yeah. The trouble is, if we put an arrangement in front of the group, but it has to be darn good to compete with Jason's stuff. So we have to make sure that it passes the test. But we started doing a little bit of that, yeah.
How about composing? Are any of you doing any composing?
No.
Not for the group?
No.
No. So just arrangement at this point.
Well, sometimes I feel like when I write an arrangement, it often feels like composing. You're taking off and, creating ideas.
Composing is a type of arranging in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. You take a small idea and expand it. And,
I agree.
I just don't trust my own small ideas to begin with. Somebody else's.
Take somebody else's great melody and then you can run with it. You know, I agree. I think arranging, it's an undersung skill.
Yeah.
You know, people who aren't musicians don't really understand why it's so important to have a good arranger, you know, because it really is the person, the magician that puts it all together and hears all those colors and all of the tonalities.
Well, just for an example, in the classical world, one of everybody's favorite classical piece pictures at an exhibition is Ravel's arrangement of Mussorgsky's piano piece.
Right.
And it's one of the top 10 pieces that orchestras play to sell tickets.
But it wasn't originally that. It was a piano piece.
It was a piano piece.
Yeah. Kind of with the jazz influence and stuff, too. You think of Duke Ellington, but, of course, Billy Strayhorn did his arrangements, most of them.
A lot of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And some original stuff. Take the A-Train, that was a Strayhorn, too.
Yeah. And so I know everybody has full-time jobs. Either you're in the orchestra, you have a job down in Chicago. Mm-hmm. How much do you get together, and would you like it to be more?
Oh, I definitely like it to be more. it's difficult to coordinate everybody's schedules. You know, two different orchestras, and then Marianne is a freelancer, has her schedule, and I have a full time job as a psychiatric nurse, and I'm also in graduate school. So
yeah, there wasn't enough already filling your days.
Right.
You have to
I could take up some new hobby of some sort, sleeping.
Yeah.
when we have a gig coming up, we play at Lineman's, we usually feel lucky if we can find one afternoon or maybe even a morning when Jason and Marianne can drive up from Chicago and we can all get together. That's usually it. And then we hope to get to the gig early enough that we can run a few things that we might have missed at the rehearsal. So it's this real seat of the pants stuff.
There's always one or two new charts to learn too, in the space of half an hour per chart. Right.
So is there any idea of taking this on the road? Would you like to tour this? Because I think it would be great on tour, and I think you'd find lots of people interested in hearing it.
We think so too, and we tried it a few years ago. I mean, we didn't try touring. Right. We actually had management once upon a time, and it didn't work very well. You know, I mean, how do you categorize it? We want so much these days to categorize it, to put it in a little box and give it a label. And this music, we haven't found a good way to do that yet. And, you know, there's the old saying about talking about music is like dancing about architecture, right? Yeah. It's better listened to than discussed. It's been kind of frustrating. And if anybody out there in Radioland has any ideas, let us know, because we don't have a clue about what to do anymore. Right. I mean, we sort of take stabs at, you know, well, let's try playing here. Let's try going there. Maybe the right person will show up who knows how to put it all together. You have to sort of make a space in your schedule to do that, which I'd be very happy to do. I'd be very willing to do that. The right opportunity has just not come up.
I've always kind of seen it, too, as one way we could approach that is to picture different orchestras as little islands we could hop to do a tour where we'd be on their programs as our group, as some side thing or some, you know, afternoon concert type thing or whatever. But, you know, play in Los Angeles, play San Francisco, play Cleveland, whatever. Because, you know, this type of stuff in a bar situation, is a little iffy. Because you really need a listening crowd.
We recently played at the Estate, the Jazz Estate, on Murray Street.
We did it.
They have a interesting thing going on Sunday evenings now, where they'll bring in sort of an acoustic style group that's not necessarily a jazz oriented group. Like, so we fit into that category really nicely, and we played at the Jazz Estate. The thing that's nice about the Jazz Estate, and then we also played at Lineman's, is we bring in a listening crowd, and then we don't even use the PA system. It's a lot easier to play when we can hear each other without having to run through microphones and speakers.
Yeah, and the comparison to chamber music here is very important, because Jason's music is very complex and intricate. And if you can't hear all the moving parts, some of which are going to be, maybe they might be soft, they might be very delicate, if you can't hear them because people are talking or because, you know, beer bottles are smashing someplace, then you might miss something really important. Right.
And cause a train wreck in the ensemble.
Exactly. And throw us off, too.
Yeah.
No,
we had somebody at Lineman's had a heart attack.
A seizure. Yeah. She had a seizure.
Jason was right there.
Right. My mom was there at that concert. My mom was a nurse. So.
She was so excited by our performance. she was
grand mauled out.
She came out of it. And
Yep. And she decided, you know, signing off on going to the hospital and everything, even though an ambulance came, and it was pretty dramatic.
Wow. Yeah.
It was a little awkward getting back on stage afterwards, you know.
Put you off your trajectory.
The slow Beethoven movement was up after she had left. And I remember thinking, is this too dark? It ended up working fine.
It worked fine.
And speaking of the Beethoven, God, that's a beautiful arrangement of that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I was listening to it, and I thought, you know, I think we could do this. I just, in terms of all the different melodic ideas that are happening at one time, and there are enough of us. It works.
It's interesting. I know what the original sounds like, but I didn't feel like I missed anything. I didn't feel like I missed pieces or colors or parts it all kind of felt as
it's
a,
all
a
pretty
piece.
Much there. Yeah. I used both the symphonic score and a piano arrangement by Liszt as the go-to sources back and forth to piece it together.
Really nice.
What I felt like about that Beethoven's Seventh Funeral March is that orchestras kind of go out of their way to try to turn that into chamber music. And we already did. We did it like chamber music. That's what big orchestras try to do with that piece. Make it more intimate, more kind of
exposed,
more vulnerable, sort of.
You know, and that's a great word for, I think, what you do. It's very complex. It requires active listening on the part of the audience, but it's also very intimate, and it's also very vulnerable. I always feel like whenever I hear you play, that I'm getting your hearts as well as the complex technical things that are going on. I feel like it's just all right there.
I think that's a big part of that is like sticking to the narrative kind of idea. There has to be a story evolving in whatever abstract way for there to be like a kind of emotional development. So for me in writing anything, there's always, you know, there's some idea you come up with and then there are 10,000 different ways you could go with that idea, all but 10 of them are horrible. And then of those 10 that are not horrible, there's two that are good, that are really good. And of those two, from that, you kind of have to surf the best ideas as they develop, you know, organically and emerging from the past ideas. So as things go, if you can manage to keep a narrative continuity of the whole thing, that's where, for me, the emotion comes in and can maintain itself and develop and not just have a series of like, nice little moments, but like a longer arc.
The Jason Seed Stringtet is Jason Seed, composition and guitar, Dan Armstrong, bass, Scott Tisdale, cello, Helen Reich, viola, Glenn Ash, violin and viola, and Marianne Parker, piano. The performance and interview was recorded in Milwaukee's Cloudland Studio last August by studio owner Larry Philibaum. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.